begin your talk on unauthorized modernities, the strange and familiar in contemporary India. Or you may have other subtitles, but we look forward very much to your talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. As Geeta said, I don't consider myself a stranger here. Professor Rothermoon was kind enough to invite me last time I came here, and I'd like to actually thank both Professor Boehm Teutelbach and Professor Dharmpal Frick for giving me this opportunity to come here again. And in fact, I want to thank Geeta also for nurturing some of the ideas that are in this paper. I must confess at the outset that it's not, I have some points, as you can see. You know, you always need a prop when you want to perform. But it's not a paper that has been written out. So I'm not going to read out, a finished paper. So you'll forgive me if I ramble a bit. But the idea, I hope, will be clear. And, I'd certainly like to pull it all together before I finish, or if not, in the discussion that follows. Let me start by trying to clarify some of the points that I'm trying to make. In fact, the way I have I had conceptualized this talk today was that it would have a couple of points and a narrative, So I'll try and do both of that today. And maybe I'll start with the couple of points that I want to make right away and then end with the narrative. The couple of points are, of course, about a terrain that has been explored and visited quite often, the terrain of modernity. So to that extent, I think some of the things that I'm going to say are going to be familiar to everybody. But I hope that some of the things will also be a little unfamiliar, a little strange. And that is what the subtitle referred to, the strange and familiar in contemporary India. Also applies to the strange and familiar in some of the things that I'm going to say today. So let me start by, what is conventionally understood as modernity. I'm going to quote from an essay which I think a lot of you may know already, and this is an essay by Dilip Gaonkar in Public Culture. It came out some years ago, 3 years ago or so, on alternative modernities. So what Gaonkar says in this essay is something I'm going to refer to and then move forward from there. But let me quote what he means by modernity. He says it involves a set of cognitive and social transformations. The cognitive transformations include or imply the growth of scientific consciousness, the development of a secular outlook, the doctrine of progress, the primacy of instrumental rationality, the fact-value split, individualistic understandings of society, and so on. The social transformations refer to the emergence and institutionalization of market-driven industrial economies, bureaucratically administered states, modes of popular government, rule of law, mass media, and increased mobility, literacy, and urbanization. In fact, my paper is going to talk, at least the narrative is about the last bit of this, which is urbanization, which I want to use as a metaphor for what I'm trying to say. So this is what Gaonkar says. And he also says in this essay, and I'm going to quote him again, creative adaptation is not simply a matter of adjusting the form or recording the practice to soften the impact of modernity. Rather, it points to the manifold ways in which people question the present. It is the site where people make themselves modern as opposed to being made modern by alien or impersonal forces, and where they give themselves an identity and destiny. So I think what Gaonkar is really doing in this essay is pointing to a shift in the discourse of modernity in India, the shift being from seeing Indians or other people in the so-called, traditional societies of the world, third world, whatever, as victims of modernity, as people, as subjects of modernity. For a long time, people were viewed in that way, or as beneficiaries of a project of modernization that has been going on for a certain period of time in India. So, but what Gaonkar does is he says people are not made modern by either systems or states or these institutions that constitute the carriers of modernity, the instruments of modernization. But he says that people make themselves modern. And this self-making involves a certain kind of agency and creativity on their part, which is what gives a different spin to the modernity of places like India. Now, so what I'm saying is that this much is already known and already understood, that India is not a conventional modern society. It is a society that is yet to arrive, perhaps, into a sense of, you know, into modernity, perhaps, you know. So you just can't say that India, like Europe or North America, is a modern society. Everybody knows that. And we also know by now, more or less, that India is not a traditional society, within quotes, however you define it. I mean, it's no longer a society which has not registered the impact of modernity, or which has continued in a certain traditional form in spite of this impact. So it's commonly recognized that there's something that is happening in India which has its own logic, its own rhythm, and that you may call it hybridity, as some people do, or you may say that it is, it is an example of how modernity has been contained, you know, in enclaves. That is one another kind of argument where you can find, you know, enclosed spaces which are modern, surrounded by spaces which are not modern. Or you can say that people have said that there's been some sort of synthesis, you know, of tradition and modernity. And from the traditional perspective, there are people who have argued that modernity in India is only a different form of Indian tradition, because tradition itself has the capacity, and not just the capacity, the critical component which is crucial to modernity. Indian tradition already possesses it. It does not have to import it from its reading or understanding of Western texts. That critical component is already present. So tradition has the capacity to renew and critique itself. And modernity is just another thing that tradition has to contend with. So there are these perspectives, and these things are already out there in the literature. So if we agree, or if we don't have to agree, of course, but if we observe that most people think that India is not modern in the sense that Europe or North America are modern, and that most people also concede that India does not remain traditional as it once was, then the question really is how to define the uniqueness of India's modernity. Let's put it that way. How to define, how to pinpoint, how to in some ways encapsulate or try to understand what constitutes this difference in India's quest for modernity, or India's experiment in modernization. And this is what I'm trying to define today, or at least one aspect of it is what I'm trying to outline today, if I succeed in what it is I'm trying to do. What I would say then is that if I just lost an idea that I had, but I hope I come back to it in a moment. Let me then talk a little more about the subtitle, which is The Strange and Familiar in Contemporary India. So this is my second interlocutor today. One was Gaonkar, whom I just quoted, and I'm going to quote the second source from which I'd like to use in what I'm doing today. And this phrase, "the strange and familiar," in a peculiar way comes, or at least a part of it comes out of a book that was written by a couple of Australians whose names are Ken Gelder and Jane Jacobs, and they've written a book called "Uncanny Australia: Sacredness and Identity in a Postcolonial Nation." And what interested me about this book is how they sort of theorize the the sign of the Aboriginal in contemporary Australian discourse. And not just the Aboriginal, but the notion of Aboriginal sacredness. And they say that the Aboriginal sacredness occupies a very uncanny public space. This is the word they use. And so so the combination of strange and unfamiliar to Gelder and Jacobs, it constitutes an uncanniness, you know. So I'm trying to say that there's something uncanny about, Indian modernity. Yeah, now I got the thought that I had, so I'll just tell you that before it's gone again. Now, in another paper that I wrote, which is actually probably in the Saundarya, right at the end, it's about the aesthetics of modernity, you know. And there I've made the point that India is neither a modern society nor an anti-modern society, you see, because there are certain societies or trends in the world that we may call counter-systemic. You know, there is a dominant world system of sorts, and then there are certain counter-systemic trends. But I argue in this that India is not counter-systemic or anti-modern either. And what I've simply said is India is non-modern. So this occupies a sort of third space, not a Bhabheian third space, which is interstitial and occurs at borders. But, you know, it's an attempt to extend the third space into a whole nation, civilization, or into a whole... It's huge. The third space here is not something which is small or delicate, but it's massive. It's a massification of a kind of third space in the contemporary world, which is, in a sense, unprecedented. So the word that I've used is non-modern there. Here I'm, throwing out another phrase, unauthorized modernity. And I'd like to believe, at least, that I may be an unauthorized, whatever, modern person in terms of what I do. But I think my talk is very much authorized, isn't it? The powers that be have whatever. But anyway, so to come back to this, to Gelder and Jacobs, the point they make, as I said, is about the paradoxical excess of the Aboriginal in Australian culture, simultaneous with the erasure of Aboriginals themselves, you see? So that if you look at there is a kind of incommensurability about the actual status of Aboriginals in Australian society. You know, their social exclusion and their general sense of marginality is obvious to anybody who studies Australia. But the notion of the Aboriginal is fundamental, it's crucial, it's actually central to Australia's self-constitution, and more so in the last 15 years than ever before. So what Gelder and Jacobs argue here is that they talk about the excess of the Aboriginal, and they say, and I'm not quoting, but I'm paraphrasing, page 22, the uncanny makes the familiar appear strange and the strange appear familiar. So familiar, how does the familiar appear strange? The real Aboriginals, they become strange. So the familiar becomes strange. And how does this strange become familiar? The notion of Aboriginality becomes extremely familiar. It's central to what white Australians or mainstream Australians are talking about all the time. And what they say then is that there is a promiscuous play between the two. The play between the what you might call the sacred, the notion of the Aboriginal sacred, right, which is the so-called marginal, and the secular dominant, which is the Australian mainstream culture. Because notions of Aboriginal sacredness are invoked time and time again, whether it is to bless the Olympic Games when they start, or whether when it is for city zoning or for taking lands or restoring rights, you know. So they are not opposed. The point is that they are not opposed in Australia, but there is a promiscuous place. So I'm taking over these ideas, with certain differences, to India, and I'm saying that in India today, there is a promiscuous play between the modern and the non-modern, right? And they solicit one another. This is what I'm trying to say. that they're not necessarily just opposed to one another, as one would have imagined, that there is this incredibly oppressive sort of modernity that is being, you know, thrust down the throats of so-called traditional people who are either passive or victims, or some are being annihilated by these forces, and that they are resisting in their own way, whether through Narmada or whatever. But what I'm trying to say is that there is, each solicits the other. So you can, you know, you can illustrate this in a variety of ways, in fact. I mean, even if you take the agitation of Narmada, you have, you know, many traditional ideas being invoked. You know, the sacredness of the river, the fact that water should flow, it shouldn't be dammed, the displacement of people, jal, jungle, zameen, the three Z's, all of that. But how do these causes, which are supposedly traditional and anti-modern, in the sense that if you look at the dam as an example of a certain kind of modernity, then how does the traditional solicit the modern? It does so by the use of several so-called modern technologies, use of internet, use of means of communication, use of a certain form of mobilization, communication, communicative action, which you might consider, you know, very modern and democratic in a modern sense. So I'm just saying that these two sort of, they're not necessarily mutually opposed and incommensurable, but they solicit each other, and there is a play that is going on. And another example can be Bollywood cinema, where its relationship to Hollywood is again uncanny. It is uncanny because you keep seeing echoes of Hollywood, as one of these famous writers of potboilers, you know, I think her name is Taylor Bradford, something Bradford Taylor, I think, Barbara, some, I can't remember. She's now put a suit in the Calcutta High Court saying that these Bombay film people, they copy all the plots of her novels, you know. They are copied without paying royalties and all that, you know. And of course, this is going to be very interesting. I don't know how the court will adjudicate, because what is involved is the issue of translation here, right? Because nobody is using English, and everything is changed. The names are changed, the setting is changed, and yet there is an unashamed kind of taking over. You see, if you have Kramer versus Kramer, you have an Indian version, you know, whatever. This is going on all the time. And yet it's Indianized, the setting is different. So it's uncanny. It's familiar, and yet it's not familiar. And once you say translation, then translation becomes very important in a general sense as a metaphor, because modernity is indeed being translated in India in a certain way. And when it is translated, translation, the word itself means to carry over. And when you carry over, certain things are left behind, certain things are taken, and there is a general process of coping and change and transformation, which makes it impossible to consider one the copy of another. It's something else. And yet there is this relationship. And I'm reminded here of what Anantamurthy says in one of his famous essays about the backyard and the front yard, you see. And he says the front yard is the West, you know. That is Shakespeare, for example. You know, I'm just really quickly summarizing, because we don't have that much time. And the backyard is Akka Mahadevi, it's your grandmother's stories and all that, you know. And he says that, you know, Indian intelligentsia, especially the English educated, is fixated and focused on the front yard, and they should look in the backyard and see what they have there. And it's really the old debate between the Anglicist and the vernacularist in India. But I would suggest, as a way of rereading Anantamurthy, that it's not that the backyard is ignored, you see, and nor is it repressed, you know. So we're not talking about the return of the repressed in any case. But it's really, there's a dialogue between the two, and they actively solicit one another. This is what I'm trying to say. So now, having made my two points here, I think I should now go to my narrative, and maybe we can stop at about five or so. Do you think is that a good time, and then have a discussion? Yeah. So rather than going on and on. The narrative about how I got this phrase unauthorized has to do with the search for an apartment in Delhi, you know. And I was corresponding with with Geeta on the on the email, and I said, should I leave this out, and rewrite the abstract and not bring in the story at all? And she says, no, it'll be very interesting, so go ahead. What I want to actually illustrate is, I'm not an urban historian by any stretch of the imagination, but I can read the urban space that is Delhi, since I live there, and the point is that I think urban historians will also, I did a little bit of research on this, and there is writing, and that in some ways corroborates what I sort of learned in a non-formal way, in a completely different way, because of a lived experience and a challenge that I had to face. Anyway, so the story starts with the search for an apartment in Delhi. I was looking for an apartment to buy, basically, because I realized that I did not own a stitch of land anywhere on this planet, and that I was getting old, so I must look for some means of, at least some roof over my head. And so the search started, and every Saturday in all the Delhi Times there are these massive advertisements, of apartments, and there's a huge construction boom in India, as those who are following these things. And that's because of several economic changes, policy changes, and more and more middle class people buy homes, they get loans from banks and so forth. So as a part of this means, this horde of people trying to get, an apartment. So I joined this, and then I realized a number of interesting things about how Delhi, the land tenure in Delhi works. The first thing is that the first kind of distinction that any Delhiite knows, and also you learn very quickly, is leasehold and freehold. These are two kinds of land in Delhi, freehold and leasehold. Now what this means is that when New Delhi was made, a lot of land was kept by the government and its agencies. And thereby hangs another interesting tale, but which will have greater interest to those who know Delhi. Because Delhi is the capital of India, everybody knows, so it's a National Capital Territory, NCR, National Capital Region, that is, or NCT. And it includes some areas around Delhi. So the central government has a direct control and stake in Delhi. But Delhi is also now a state. So there is the central government and their jurisdiction, then there is the state government and their jurisdiction, and then there are other bodies who run Delhi. One is the Municipal Corporation of Delhi, and then the other thing is Delhi Municipal Committee, New Delhi NDMC, New Delhi Municipal Committee. So there is an area called New Delhi, which is run by a corporation called New Delhi Municipal Committee. And when you and you can notice it if you're in Delhi, if you're driving towards the heart of Delhi from the south or from any part of Delhi, when you enter New Delhi, you will immediately realize that you're in a different place. I mean, the roads are broad and clean, the traffic is less, the boulevards are lined by trees, the civic amenities suddenly start looking better. And it's very dramatic if you are, as I said, if you drive from South Delhi to Central Delhi, when you cross the All India Institute of Medical Sciences and go across the Ring Road, you know you're in New Delhi. I mean, and then you pass Lodi Gardens and all these nice places, and you come to Tughlaq Road, and suddenly the population density reduces by 100 or 1,000, whatever. You have big bungalows and etc. Now, so there is land that is owned by New Delhi Municipal Committee. There is land owned by the central government. There's land owned by the state government. Then there's Municipal Corporation of Delhi, which looks after the rest of Delhi and is underfunded. And, there's garbage or whatever. Roads are bad. But what Delhi did is they also set up these other institutions, semi-government. One was called the DDA, the Delhi Development Authority. And what DDA did is that they took a lot of these lands that the government owned and developed properties and colonies. They became a developer, right? And this land was leasehold, because the land belongs to the President of India, technically. So if you have a DDA flat, anybody here might, somebody might have a DDA flat. It's the boon of the middle class, At one time they were very affordable, but now they're as expensive as any. But of course they're the construction is really rotten, literally. You don't know when the roof will collapse or what's going to happen. But, you know, a lot of us, I live in a DDA flat right now, but I mean, we can be thankful that, you know, we have some place to stay because they made it reasonably affordable. But anyway, so you signed up, you signed a lease with the government of India, right? Now, of course, they're trying to make leasehold into freehold. But as I said, the other category, there was some land that they gave out as freehold. Greater Kailash, Sundar Nagar, these are examples, you know. Lajpat Nagar, perhaps. No, Lajpat Nagar is again leasehold being made into freehold. So there are these different colonies in Delhi. Now, if you want to buy an apartment, first of all, freehold properties are incredibly expensive, as expensive as New York, perhaps, you know, or even more in some respects, you know. So we are talking about if you want an independent house, a couple of $100,000 is okay, a small change. Converted to rupees, it's crores, you know, it's like tens of millions of rupees, you know, for a not necessarily a luxurious sort of palatial house, you know, but if you want a house in Sundar Nagar, an independent house, it may cost about at least $100,000 or more, I think. Anyway, so the point is, so there is the pricing is also dependent on the way the land tenure works. Then DDA are much cheaper, you know, and they are, they go to about, they start around 20 million Indian rupees, you know, for flats now, three-bedroom flats, or two-bedroom flats are about 20 million, and then they go up. That's about, not 20 million, 2 million, sorry, 2 million, and then they go up. Rupees, 2 million rupees, that's about 20 lakhs is the minimum, and then it goes. So what I'm trying to say is the first thing I noticed is I couldn't afford these. That's the point I'm coming to. Then I began to check out other places, right? And then you find that you have to go to Gurgaon or, you know, Noida and so forth. But the point is somewhere between this transition from New Delhi to Gurgaon, I came across a very interesting ad in the newspaper for an apartment building, for an apartment in a very nice, what I thought was a nice place, which was Mehroli. I mean, it was bang next to a historic monument, a lovely monument really, and very close to Qutub Minar. I mean, from the roof of this apartment building, you could see Qutub Minar, you know, and it was a stone's throw away from Qutub Minar. And, you know, it had this curving road going inside, you know, and beautiful, really beautiful. And of course I met the builder, and it's interesting, the builder lived in a place called Sainik Farms, you know, and those who know Delhi, Sainik Farms is a notorious colony which was started for ex-service people, and it's got huge, buildings, huge mansions which are very expensive there, but they get no electricity, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So they have these generators, and they are very rich people who live there. But I met this person in Sainik Farms, and we had a kind of negotiation about the price and everything. And then I went, and it's a very nice apartment building. You know, I mean, I could spend more time, I mean, as a writer, to tell you how I went there, how I parked underground, how there was a man who opened the door for me, and how I went into a lift, and how it's nicely landscaped, and how it's pretty, and the light comes in, and the... And then I looked out of the window of one of the flats, and there was a lot of noise, and I looked, and there was a kind of car garage, you know. And the gap between the wall of the apartment building and the garage was non-existent. I mean, you could sort of jump into that, or well, it was 3 feet or 4 feet, you know. And then, I went on the other side, and, there was an empty plot, and there were some cattle grazing there, you know. And then I went to the third side, and there was a ruin there, and... You know, some old building was in ruins there, and all of that. And I was just taking these things in, and the thing I noticed though is that everything seemed to be rather cramped. You know, the wall, the compound wall of the building, you know, was very close to the entrance. You know, and the parking was underground and everything. And I said, okay, this looks like a good place. And so I went to my bank. The State Bank of India, where my salary is deposited, so they know that I'm reliable, whatever. So, and I said that, you know, I'd like to take a loan to buy an apartment in this. So they said, yeah, sure, you fill out these papers, and, you know, you give me these documents, and, you know, and we'll go through it. So when I did all that, and then after a while, the manager called me up and said, we're sorry, we cannot give you a loan for this place. So I said, why is that? So he says that, well, there are some problems with this property. So I said, what are the problems? So they said, oh, you better talk to our lawyer. So I called up the lawyer, and the lawyer said, sir, this is an unauthorized construction. So this is where the word comes, unauthorized modernity. Now what I realized is that, what does this mean? Then I did some research after a while, and I found that there are seven types of land holding in Delhi, you know, and I told you two or three already. Central government land, state government land, then NDMC land, DDA land, you know, MCD land. These are the very, you know, no problem, there's all government. Then leasehold land and freehold land, both authorized. Now you come to other kinds of land in Delhi. One are the shanty towns, you know, or slums, you know, Jhuggi Jhopri, they're called Jhuggi Jhopri clusters. JJC, Jhuggi Jhopri clusters. Now these are completely unauthorized. That means some people come from the village or wherever they come from, and near the worst parts of Delhi, near the drains or someplace, they put up a little shack. In time, there's millions of them staying, and you can't remove them because then they get votes. So, you know, they are not totally unauthorized because they vote. Some of them have ration cards, they tap electricity from the, you know, the lines that go overhead, they get free electricity, some have televisions. So Jhuggi Jhopri clusters, you know, and the government in its compassion builds public toilets for them, you know. But if you, you know, you don't have to read Nepal, you just have to travel by train to know that they're not sufficient. So at the other end of the spectrum are Jhuggi Jhopri clusters. Then in between, there's other kinds of land tenure that I recognize, I mean, learn to recognize. One were unauthorized regularized colonies. So what this means is that, like Sainik Farms, it's not yet regularized, but there were others. Now there's some politician or somebody who's from there, and as a favor to his supporters, you know, he goes through the legislative procedures and says that this is unauthorized. Yes, nobody gave them permission, they just, whatever, took over the land and did whatever they did, but now we'll authorize it. So we'll give them sewerage, we will give them an electricity, you can get a meter, you know. Because when I was looking at this apartment, somebody says, do you have a meter in your own room? I said, of course. But then I found out there was one big meter for the whole apartment building, and they had made this little meters, you know. So I'll come to exactly what this man had done in a moment. But so unauthorized, regularized. And then there are unauthorized period, like Sainik Farms. And since it's full of rich people, what happens is they send bulldozers, and one or two houses are destroyed. But then, you know, you bribe somebody, and, you know, they cut off the electricity, they put up generators, and, you know, you can't get rid of them, basically. They're there, and there's many of them are brigadiers and generals, politicians, important people who live in these. So Sainik Farms is the best example of an unauthorized colony which is flourishing in Delhi. But a sign that it is unauthorized is you can never find a house then inside there. I mean, because people have numbered their homes any which way they like. If it's an authorized colony, there'll be some rationality in numbering, you know. So there'll be 222 by A by 7 by 3. So you can never find this place unless someone tells you turn left, turn right, there'll be a chowkidar, then you know, make a U-turn and so forth. And the roads are very tiny. But they're luxurious mansions. So I should have been clued in when I saw that the man who owned the apartment building lived in an unauthorized colony himself, right? But anyway, now there's another kind of land tenure in Delhi. Delhi has about 250 villages. Now this is where it, you know, the real point about what I'm going to say comes in. So there were villages all over the place which is Delhi, and gradually the city swallowed up these villages, right? And in my previous job at the Indian Institute of Technology, this is the best example of what I mean. The Indian Institute of Technology, which is a very modern institution, was built on land which belonged to farmers. And it is actually the other side of the road from where Geeta grew up. She said that there's a big house full of fields there. There's not a single field for 20 miles from that place now. But just 30, 40 years ago, or 30 years ago, there was nothing south of Hauskas. There was nothing all the way to Mehroli. So what they did, how modernity solicits tradition and vice versa. the farmers, and they were Gujars and Jats who lived there, IIT told them, we'll take over your land. They lived in two places, Jia Sarai, Ber Sarai, these were the names of the traditional villages, and they had farms there, the rest of the place. And IIT is about 175, 200 acres. They took over the land and said, from every home, we'll give you one job. And that is why I realized very much later why the IIT karamcharis, or the work people who do the work, the staff, were so inefficient. Because they all had jobs, they were guaranteed jobs, and they were not only inefficient, but they were surly, they were rude, because they said, you built an institute on our lands, you know, so you had to coax and cajole them to do what was their duty, you know, and they were all little landlords in Jia Sarai and Ber Sarai. You know. So now what the British did is, when they saw the urbanization of rural places, they developed a concept called Lal Dora. Lal Dora means red thread. So they said that village areas will be called Lal Dora. And in Lal Dora, the municipal rules will not apply. So these Lal Dora areas, you know, normally municipal rules means you have to leave so much frontage, you know, you have to leave, so I mean, you can only build up so much, 60% of the plot can be built up, the rest has to be left, you have to have so much of a gap, the street has to be so wide, this is the kind of drainage you need, you know. And you pay betterment charges to get this. But in Lal Dora areas, villagers could live the way they wanted. So you have very narrow streets, they build really close to one another. But some of Delhi's most chic localities now are in this Lal Dora. This is a loophole. So Horse Khas with its designers and all the fashion designing in Delhi is in a village called Horse Khas. And they went there because all these places are outside the urban rules and regulations, and you can do anything you like there, you see. And of course, the sale of leasehold land was done through notary in Delhi. So the title was never transferred to your name, and you could sell it 10 times with just a piece of paper. Of course, if you were cheated, that was the end of it, you know. But these Lal Dora areas gave property developers a chance to exploit a loophole in the law. And of course, there's another act of the DDA which says that once you're in the Delhi urban limits, Lal Dora does not apply and all the municipal rules will apply. But how can they do it? Even if they want to demolish an unauthorized construction, the lane is so narrow that the bulldozer can't go in. So, you know, so it will never be applied. I mean, those laws. So, in fact, I called up somebody in DDA. When they told me that the apartment building is in a Lal Dora area, I said, is it safe? He said, yeah, because you can never demolish it. And then I realized what they did. That's why they didn't have the requisite frontage. You know, they built 3.5, you can only build 30 feet in Delhi, or 40 feet. But he had one or two extra stories. And the top story was inhabited by a Swami who was close to the BJP government. So they said, they'll never demolish the top story. Don't worry. I mean, though it's unauthorized, you know. And the sewerage they had taken, because there was a main sewer line, this apartment was unauthorized, so there had no sewerage. So they dug a tunnel and they connected with the main sewer line about, I think, about 20 meters away. And they just dumped the, you know. So, but again, nothing will happen because the man has bribed everybody. And the lawyer told me that if you go to Mehroli, he says, I don't even step into the Mehroli Tehsil area. I said, why? He said, because you'll never get an original document. Everything is forged. You know, forgery upon forgery upon forgery. So you never know who owns the original land in that precinct of Mehroli, which has again become a very fashionable area. So Delhi, in other words, like a modern Indian metropolis, has villages and urban spaces, and they are not necessarily in conflict, but they solicit each other. And in fact, the multinationals prefer Lal Doras now, because they can do whatever they like there, and it's much cheaper than having to fork out millions and millions of rupees of rent in Connaught Place or some other area. So needless to say, being a very timid middle-class person, I did not buy that apartment because, you know, I just felt that I did not want to live in an unauthorized building. But the story doesn't end there, because after I did a little more research, I found that even the authorized buildings in freehold or leasehold areas had a number of unauthorized constructions. So DDA houses have balconies, additional rooms, they change the plan without permission, and every house in the authorized freehold colonies, they build right up to the street, and they actually take over a little strip of the street where they plant trees, you know. So if you look at it, if a house is allowed to have two stories, it will have three stories and a basement. So the basement and the top story is unauthorized, but each produces rent. I mean, it's extremely lucrative. So then I began to see, my goodness, all of Delhi is unauthorized, except perhaps Rashtrapati Bhavan, where the president lives, or where the parliament house is. They have obeyed all the rules. But every other part, Lalu Prasad, when he was in Delhi, he made a fish pond in his backyard because he liked fresh fish. And he brought all his cows because he wanted fresh milk. And New Delhi zoning laws disallow any dairy in the New Delhi municipal limits. But Lalu Prasad Yadav, you know, chief minister of Bihar, unauthorized, but very legal in a way. I mean, so all of Delhi is unauthorized. And then I began to think that maybe all of India is unauthorized from a certain point of view. I mean, nothing is what it is supposed to be. Everything is something other than what it pretends to be. You know, so the notion of authorized is also linked up with the notion of authority and authorship, right? And if you, in a sense, what postmodernists have said, Roland Barthes and Foucault, they've talked about the author function, the death of the author, and so forth. What that means is that every reader becomes an author, right? The author who is supposed to lend credence to the meaning of a text is absent. So you have absent authority, and every reader becomes an author. In that sense, what India has done is it has taken the text of modernity, a text that the West wrote perhaps, and then it has treated it as if the author is dead. So every person who reads the text has become an author, you know. So they read it their own way, and it's something different. Just to end, I want to again come back to a point. And the point to me is that modernity, at least in the Western sense, well, maybe two points. The first point is, how do you theorize modernity? And again, if you read something like what Lyotard has done in The Postmodern Condition, he suggests that postmodernity in some ways precedes modernity, you know, because, and I read that in a slightly different way, which is that if modernity represents a particular kind of rationality, you know, even at the very inception of its institutionalization, there are other possibilities which are either erased or shoved underground or debated or whatever before modernity hegemonizes, just as what you do with when a particular kind of religion spreads in Rome. The pagan practices get outlawed, but something happens to them. They go underground, and there's the return of the repressed. This is what happens in the West. There is the other. It is not acknowledged, but it is, you know, and so you have every now and then a resurgence of something like that coming from within, and as the, you know, as Adorno and others have said, that modernity itself is not rational, that the heart of the rationality is a mythic structure which doesn't go away. So, you know, if you look at it like that, then I would say that at any given instance, there is always a plurality of possibilities, even if one of them then gets institutionalized. And when we come to a society like India and the possibility of constructing an alternativity, you know, which was the other title I had, subtitle, and Gita said, no, it's hard even to pronounce, so why do you bring it up? I think if India is a non-modern society which is trying to establish an alternativity, you know, as opposed to the modernity that the West represents, then I would say that ultimately that alternativity will have to be built upon a different kind of rationality itself. And this seems paradoxical, because everybody said the rationality is universal. You cannot have rationalities, you cannot have modernities, there is only modernity, right? But I would say that these other rationalities may be unauthorized, they may be fugitive rationalities, right? But they still exist, and these are in the process of creating these alternative kinds of societies, which I think augur well for our planet, because they suggest a plurality and not a monoculture which in its relentless spread is going to swamp out everything else. And that is why when my Marxist friends complain about globalization, I tell them to relax, because you know India has the, you know, again to go back to what Anantamurthy said, he said the vernaculars have the digestive power to deal with English. So you eat something, you can digest it, then it gives you health and strength. If you can't, you get an upset stomach, or God knows what can happen, a Delhi belly, you know. So I don't think modernity has given us a Delhi belly. In fact, I would say that I think India has the capacity perhaps to digest it and to produce something different. Thank you very much.